This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
It feels like we're all being told to go on this diet, take that supplement. Ozempic will give you depression, but you know what'll cure that? Weed. Or you could try to balance your hormones. At Science Versus, we're like,
what the f*** is going on?
Forget the crap online and listen to Science Versus. Just the facts. Oh, and a bunch of stupid jokes.
What is a ghost's favorite fruit? Booberries.
That's Science VS. New season out on Spotify soon.
In the midst of World War I, Europe was on fire. Soldiers from every country on the continent were slaughtered and killed in the great game of domination.
Hospitals were stuffed to the brim, overflowing with gore and suffering. It was all one nurse could do to hush her patients to sleep and to tell them of better times to come.
But in a few months, when some of her patients had indeed been healed and the peace treaty of Versailles had been signed, this nurse would be the one still struggling.
Fever, flu, doctors, friends, family, they could do nothing but watch as this woman, once tasked with healing others, fell into an unresponsive and paralytic stupor.
Her eyes twitched, and then her eyelids closed. They wouldn't open again for many, many years. The Great War may have ended, but a new conflict had begun, and like the war, it was about to spread worldwide.
When our bodies fail, we trust doctors to diagnose the problem. But medicine isn't always an exact science. Sometimes it's a guessing game with life or death stakes.
This is Medical Mysteries, a Parcast original. I'm Molly.
And I'm Richard. Every Tuesday, we'll look at the strangest real-life medical cases in history and the experts who raced against the clock to solve them.
As we follow these high-intensity stories, we'll explore medical research that might solve the puzzle. Next week, in part two, we'll analyze all the evidence and try to find an answer.
You can find episodes of Medical Mysteries and all other Parcast originals for free on Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. To stream Medical Mysteries for free on Spotify, just open the app and type Medical Mysteries in the search bar.
At Parcast, we're grateful for you, our listeners. You allow us to do what we love. Let us know how we're doing. Reach out on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network.
This is our first episode on encephalitis lethargica, an epidemic that swept across the world in the wake of World War I, plunging countless people into seemingly incurable sleeping sickness. This week, we'll trace the timeline of the initial outbreak and the global effort to diagnose the mystery infection before it was too late. Next week, we'll dive deeper into the stories of those who lived through the epidemic and the miracle drug that held the potential to cure them.
It was 1918, and it seemed like the end of the world. Not only was the Great War burning the glory of old Europe to the ground, but the infamous Spanish influenza was gearing up to reach pandemic status.
By the time influenza rates cooled down in 1920, over 500 million people had been infected worldwide, with an estimated death toll of anywhere from 50 million to 100 million. It was as if the Black Death had returned for its 20th century vengeance.
But in its wake, another scourge crept silently across the world. Although it was not nearly as deadly, it proved to be a much greater mystery, with myths and misinformation proliferating about it into the modern day.
It was a very specific type of encephalitis, a broad term used by doctors to describe a swelling of the brain. Different types of encephalitis can be caused by different factors, from viruses to bacteria, and can result in many varied symptoms.
What made encephalitis lethargica, or EL, such an unruly beast was that even beneath the umbrella of encephalitic diseases, it was still difficult to categorize. Doctors struggled to pin down a distinct diagnosis that could unify the countless individual cases arriving from across the world.
Dr. Joel Vilinsky, who compiled the great modern text on the disease, Encephalitis Lethargica, During and After the Epidemic, argued that we cannot even be certain if all reported cases of EL described one disease.
Vilinsky quoted German writer S. Winkel, who evoked philosophy in thinking about the causes and mystery of EL. What we often find in such cases, as with Plato's cave metaphor, are only the shadows of reality, which allow no certainty, only supposition.
But if we are to probe this mystery that has confounded medical professionals for decades, one thing is clear. We must begin with an Austrian doctor who practiced at the dawn of the 20th century. We must return to the time of war and influenza.
It was early February 1917 when Konstantin von Economo came face to face with a patient who would change the course of his life and legacy. She seemed to be an otherwise normal 31-year-old woman, except for the fact that she could not bring herself to keep her eyes open.
Von Economo recorded his findings as he observed her decline into a deeper stupor throughout the month of February. When she was awake, her eyes displayed signs of ptosis, or a lazy eye.
Upon closer examination, von Economo determined that the nerves that controlled her eye and eyelid movement were inhibited.
This discovery was soon dwarfed by another. Von Economo began asking questions during the woman's period of heavy sleep. He wanted to test her somnolence, or seemingly endless desire for rest.
Strangely enough, when prompted by the doctor, the woman's days would suddenly end, and she answered in a normal tone of voice. If von Economo or another nurse kept her engaged, this attentiveness continued. But if they stopped speaking with her, even for a moment,
her eyes would close as if under a heavy weight, and the somnolence would return. It was this that truly piqued von Economo's curiosity. He wondered whether the woman was actually snapping into and out of deep sleep, or if there was a neurological infection behind the paralysis of her ocular nerves.
In other words, was this potential pseudosomnolence or false sleep the sign of some unknown and uncharted disease? Von Economo had read a few earlier records of what were sometimes referred to as sleeping sicknesses. One such disease stood out in particular, an Italian illness called la nona.
This particular affliction appeared in southern Italy during the time of the 1889 Asiatic flu outbreak. Von Economo actually recalled his Italian grandmother's stories of the affliction. La nona seemed to be a follow-up disease that came after someone had recovered from the flu.
Those afflicted would enter periods of hypersomnolence or excessive daytime sleepiness. Unlike von Economo's 1917 case, these people could not be easily awakened. It was a much more catatonic state. La nona also produced muscular stiffness and pupil dilation.
This childhood bedtime story had now become a reality for von Economo. Case 1's condition lasted 4 months. But soon there was another patient in the ward with similar symptoms, a 17-year-old girl who arrived with a headache, a stiff neck, and signs of delirium. She quickly fell into a sleeping stupor just like the previous case.
The girl's condition stretched out for over 2.5 months. Von Economo was able to prompt attentiveness from this girl in the same way as he did from his first patient. She awakened to clearly answer his queries, even from the depth of her stupor. When von Economo also detected a certain rigidity in her muscles, this time in her lower body, he realized this disease was something new.
the influx of patients continued. Next was a 38-year-old school teacher on February 27th who suffered from delirium, heavy sleep, and ocular paralysis. At the end of March, another teenage girl appeared in Von Economo's ward, shivering, disoriented, and infinitely tired. She died before the month was out.
In total, 11 cases arrived on Von Economo's doorstep that seemed to belong to the same category of illness. In three of them, Von Economo noted clearly that the patient's drowsiness was not connected with diminished consciousness. He officially termed this pseudosomnolence.
At least five of Economo's 11 patients perished within months of being admitted, all before the end of 1917. In the final two cases, a 14-year-old girl and 12-year-old boy, post-mortem examination of the brains found swelling. In Von Economo's professional opinion, this was encephalitis. But as we mentioned earlier, that's a large umbrella term.
Von Economo decided it was time to add a new entry under that qualification. Although some in Austria and Germany would call it Von Economo's disease, from the beginning, this doctor deemed it encephalitis lethargica.
Von Economo published two articles in 1917. In the first, he outlined his search for a cause. His initial suspicion was that it must have something to do with the conflict raging around the world. He tried to find evidence of food poisoning caused by a lack of good nutrition during wartime, but there was not enough gastrointestinal disturbance in any of his cases to justify this.
He then wondered if it could have anything to do with poisonous gas due to the heavy usage of chemical warfare across the European countryside. However, beyond speculation, there was simply no evidence.
But his colleague, Professor von Wiesner, suspected it might be caused by an infection. Von Wiesner successfully injected the infected brain tissue of the 12-year-old boy from case 10 into a lab monkey. The monkey contracted encephalitis and died within 2 days.
In his second article, published in 1917, Von Economo presented this as evidence that encephalitis lethargica was caused by some unidentified infectious virus. He also mused that there could be some connection between EL and the rising body count of the ongoing Spanish influenza outbreak.
He never forgot about La Nona that his grandmother had described to him, and the mysterious sleeping sickness's connection to the flu pandemic of 1889.
Unfortunately, it would be hard to test this theory without data from other countries. At the time, communication was completely shattered between the medical communities across the world. Austria-Hungary had been on the wrong side of the war, and as Walensky writes, foreign journals from behind enemy lines were probably not distributed until after the war ended in 1918. On top of that, it took another 5 decades for Von Economo's original articles to be published in English.
Perhaps if the medical world was above the political one, this mystery could have been solved, since cases of EL were simultaneously popping up and being recorded elsewhere in Europe. But instead, with the chaos of the Great War clouding the thoughts of the world's best minds, encephalitis lethargica erupted into a full-on epidemic.
When we return, we'll see how encephalitis lethargica reared its ugly head in the rest of the world. And now, back to the story.
In Austria in 1917, Dr. Konstantin von Economo discovered encephalitis lethargica, a strange sleeping sickness caused by a swelling in the brain. But the rest of the world was in the dark about the nature of the disease. Doctors in countries across Europe and eventually the United States and beyond had to encounter the same array of symptoms blind.
Between 1917 and 1926, the disease began to crop up in large numbers in countries all over the world. It was officially an epidemic.
According to the Center for Disease Control, epidemic conditions are defined as the occurrence of more cases of disease than expected in a given area or among a specific group of people over a particular period of time.
This certainly described what was happening with EL, but it would take nearly a decade for large amounts of this research to link together and create a global portrait of what was happening. Until then, there was a lot of blind fire diagnoses and simultaneous discoveries because EL was showing up everywhere, fast.
In his second 1917 paper, von Economo theorized that the massive movements of troops across Europe could have been tied to the spread of the disease. Unfortunately, no one had the perspective, time, or resources to actually measure that at the time.
Meanwhile, across the border in France, Dr. René Cruchet began to uncover a strange new variation of encephalitis at his military hospital. In fact, his caseload put von Economo's to shame. There were over 40 people in Cruchet's hospital that suffered from the same symptoms, some of which hadn't been observed by von Economo.
Lethargy, physical and mental, pounding headaches, strange facial contortions and paralysis. Cruchet observed all of this and put together a very similar disease theory to von Economo's. Later, a few years after the war, Cruchet would vie for the top slot, claiming his own writings on EL were completed weeks before von Economo ever published his first paper.
Unsurprisingly, Cruchet also refused to call the disease encephalitis lethargica. Instead, he offered up the disease of Cruchet in its place. Not only had EL gone multinational, but it had also kickstarted a competition to claim its discovery.
In 1918, it was Dr. Arnold Netter who published the first official French report on EL, as Dr. Cruchet had not put out a collected report. Meanwhile, in England, early observation of the disease were made by Dr. Arthur Hall. Hall based his own writing on over 126 case files. He noted strange behavioral changes in his patients, as some laughed or cried without apparent cause.
He also made key observations as to the restlessness of those who had EL, signs that often presaged a turn toward muscular paralysis. Distinctively, he noted that patients' faces became mask-like and expressionless.
By 1920, enough post-mortem examinations had been conducted to reveal that brain lesions were very common in those who suffered from EL over an extended period of months or years.
When recorded cases started popping up in the United States in 1920 and 1921, the list of possible symptoms for diagnosis had grown to be extensive, almost too extensive for anyone's good.
In 1921, the biologist Raymond Pearl at Johns Hopkins analyzed over 549 American cases of EL in putting together his own profile of the epidemic. That same year, U.S. public health official H.F. Smith described EL's aspects as a gradual onset with headache, vertigo, disturbances of vision, ocular palsies, changes in speech, difficulty in swallowing, fever, obstinate constipation, incontinence of urine, a peculiar mask-like expression of the face, and a state of lethargy which gradually develops into the majority of the recognized cases into a coma that is more or less profound.
Clearly, the number of possible symptoms had become unwieldy. And although EL had gone global, there was an emerging confusion of terms. In retrospect, Joel Valinsky, author of Encephalitis Lethargica, During and After the Epidemic, believed that it might have been overdiagnosed by close to 50%, meaning almost half of the diagnosed patients may have been suffering from a disease that was not EL.
The reason the disease may have been overdiagnosed was due to a proliferation of possible symptoms. Encephalitis lethargica, itself already a subcategory of encephalitis, was being redefined as another series of subconditions. Some doctors and researchers believed these subcategories to be delusions. It was more likely they were different diseases entirely.
Yet other doctors still argued that EL was a singular disease. They believe the variant symptoms were simply the result of miscommunication, with researchers recording patients' statuses at different points in the disease timeline.
By now, von Economo's original observations of the disease had become known as somnolent ophthalmoplegic EL, or what we will call primary EL. As its name declares, the main symptoms of this condition were twofold.
First, there was the alternation between hypersomnolence, or deep, unshakable sleep, and pseudosomnolence, where the patient could be awakened briefly to answer questions. Secondly, there was a state of weakened or paralyzed ocular muscles.
Von Economo also made room for psychiatric shifts in this diagnosis. This had especially been observed in children who displayed drastic shifts in personality. Inhibitions vanished, and antisocial behavior took over. Some of von Economo's child patients even told him flat out, "I cannot help it. I have got to do it. I know that I am impertinent and do not want to be."
However, where von Economo saw one unified disease, even tying his EL back to his grandmother's stories of La Nona, others decided that more specific definitions were needed. For example, when some doctors were faced with patients experiencing extensive hallucinations, they diagnosed the cause as psychiatric encephalitis lethargica.
In the same vein, if a doctor believed their patient's primary symptoms revolved around muscular rigidity, movement inhibition, or that peculiar masked face look, there was a specific EL diagnosis for that. Alternatively, if patients were prone to seizure-like symptoms and intense restlessness, there was a different subset of EL diagnosis for that.
This became the main trouble in the epidemic period, as the potential forms of EL ballooned to over 30 different subcategories.
Or as Vilensky proffered, perhaps EL was never one disease at all. What von Economo observed in his original 11 cases could have been one type of infectious disease, while the hundreds of cases studied by Pearl in the U.S. could have been a collection of many different diseases. Some of them could have been EL, but not all of them.
Researcher Kenton Croker had different suspicions. He theorized that this massive influx of distinct diagnoses arose for political reasons.
Some early 20th century neurologists worried funding in their field was drying up due to a lack of breakthroughs. So, Croker speculates, perhaps neurologists decided to use the mystery of EL to fuel their profession's relevance and secure funding for future research.
However, in our opinion, EL cannot be written off entirely as a mass of misdiagnoses and neurological politics. Over 500,000 people worldwide have been said to have suffered from it since 1917.
Even if that number was exaggerated by poor record-keeping and out-of-date medical research in a chaotic time, the sheer size of the epidemic cannot be ignored. Something was spreading around the world, and it wasn't just Spanish flu. There were too many people falling into sleeping stupors for it to be mere coincidence.
If this was a real contagion, the pattern of its infection path was of the utmost importance. According to Vilensky's research, the earliest infections in this time period occurred in Romania, France, or Austria between 1915 and 1917, and have spread from east to west across the world.
1917 saw EL's debut in Italy, France, Germany, and Morocco. From there, it eventually reached Ireland, Scotland, England, Belgium, Sweden, Yugoslavia, Algeria, South Africa, Switzerland, Norway, Portugal, Spain, Bulgaria, Russia, India, China, Japan, and the United States. There were also reported cases scattered across South America before the end of 1919.
But even after EL had infected the world, no one understood how it transmitted itself across war-torn borders and vast oceans.
The only real theory was that the movement of World War I armies contributed to the quick diffusion of EL across the continents. But a privately funded 1929 study dismissed this explanation, stating that epidemics in armies have been rare. And anyway, if that had been the case, many more soldiers and their families would have been infected. Valinsky backs up this conclusion, pointing out the rarity of familial and case-to-case infections.
Yet, even though no one could figure out how EL was transferred, it must have been contagious. Professor von Wiesner successfully injected a monkey with the disease years earlier, and there were some case studies that suggested it could be communicable between humans as well.
For example, take the case of the Derby and Derbyshire Rescue and Training Home for Young Women. This was an etiquette school in the idyllic countryside of England, where women of all ages were sent to learn how to fit into society. Its quaint isolation was interrupted in August 1919.
Dr. A. Salisbury McNulty, an expert in bacterial contagion, was called to the home after 12 of the 21 women at Derby fell ill on August 14th. But McNulty could do nothing for them. Within 10 days, six of the women were dead. McNulty found no evidence of environmental factors in the mass death.
Even in post-mortem examination, McNulty only found distinct signs of brain lesions in one of the deceased. He believed the rest of the women had died before the characteristic brain damage could even manifest. But what had killed them so quickly? And why had they all been infected simultaneously?
It seems undeniable that their close proximity must have something to do with it. But beyond this, McNulty was left without answers. The rest of the women were still healthy, at least during the doctor's time at the home. His staunch confidence had been shaken as he left Derby for the city, and a marked paranoia regarding EL nagged him for the rest of his life.
Another tragic incidence of rapid infection took place in the Hospital of Elizabeth University in Hungary during the fall of 1921. The records from an anonymous doctor from that time read almost like a horror story.
One child fell ill with what the doctors thought was bronchitis. As they always did, the staff kept the sick infants separated from one another, but like clockwork.
Soon, 10 infants suffered from the same overwhelming cough, and within a week, 9 of them were dead. The anonymous doctor's only theory was that the contagion could have been passed along in the bathing chamber, as all the children were washed in the same place. Without a doubt in his mind, this doctor believed EL to be the culprit.
Of course, like Croker, one could write off these cases on the ambiguity inherent in EL diagnosis. Perhaps these doctors were incorrect in thinking either of these cases were part of the larger epidemic. But another case report from 1921, this time from France, cannot be denied in the same fashion, because the physician and patient were one in the same.
The doctor's name was G.A. Delatire. In 1919, he traveled to Morocco. In his own words, Delatire went there to attend a Jewish woman who slept. He could not understand it and could not give a diagnosis. From our perspective, it seems obvious that this woman was one of the sufferers of EL later cataloged in North Africa.
Upon Delatire's return to Paris in November, a week later, a change came over him. He wrote that his desire to sleep became irresistible. He also believed he was producing more saliva than usual and had to constantly carry around a handkerchief to keep himself clean.
By December 14th, he had been looked over by France's resident EL expert, Dr. Arnold Netter, and given his diagnosis. For months, his lethargy traded places with a hyper-excitability, and his body was plagued with aches and pain.
Things continued in this manner for 8 months, and then the symptoms subsided. Aside from unexplainable pains that occasionally arose and a permanently heightened anxiety, Delatire believed himself freed from his affliction.
Delatire's account proves that EL could somehow be transmitted through direct contact. Both Arnold Netter and McNulty eventually hypothesized that saliva was the primary vessel of EL transmission. In the Derby, Hungary, and Delatire cases, this seems to track.
But even to this day, there remains no definitive explanation for the epidemic of encephalitis lethargica. When we return, we will follow the epidemic to its end and witness the final surge of research in the battle against the mysteries of EL and its cause.
And now, back to the story. By the second half of the 1920s, encephalitis lethargica was recognized as a worldwide epidemic. Specific diagnoses and symptoms ranged across 30 different definitions of EL, but the core understanding of the disease revolved around the swelling of the brain and pseudosomnolence.
Whether or not EL was a single, unifying condition, it cannot be denied that there was now a definite desire for increased funding in neurology. People needed to understand the connections between the brain and the body. Otherwise, who knew how long and how far this epidemic could stretch? That, at least, was the thinking of one William J. Matheson.
Matheson was a chemical industrialist, a titan of rising 20th century America. According to the doctrine of the era, his wealth made him invincible in this country. But E.L. knew no such boundaries. He was struck low in 1927, just the same as any working-class laborer at his company might have been.
In desperation, Matheson used his massive wealth to fund research into his disease. He founded and funded the Matheson Commission at Columbia University to the tune of $10,000 a year. He was certain that with the best possible researchers on his payroll, they could find a cure.
Unfortunately, Matheson passed away in 1930, just as the commission began their monumental task. Dr. Josephine Neal, an expert neurologist and bacteriologist, took up his quest and led the commission's studies.
The commission published four massive reports in 1929, 1932, 1939, and 1942. If nothing else, we have the Matheson Commission to thank for collating a massive amount of data. This work fueled Valensky's modern-day efforts at pulling together the most accurate perspective on the EL epidemic.
The epidemic numbers the Matheson report contained are much lower than some other countries' estimates of 500,000, probably because they limited their study to a shorter period of time. Neal and her researchers believed that there had been 52,781 cases of EL between 1919 and 1928.
However, it must be said that the Matheson Commission made no distinction between the variants of EL, although they did try to exclude some reported diagnoses that seemed far from the mark. Like von Economo, Neal made the presence of lethargy or sleeping disorders the most distinctive sign of EL.
Neal also made the case for developing an EL vaccine. This came from the Matheson Commission's study of work done by Dr. E. C. Rosenau at the Mayo Clinic in 1922.
Rosenau, like von Economo before him, believed that it would be possible to isolate the infectious agent responsible for EL and develop a vaccine to counteract it. As he conducted postmortem studies of potential EL victims, Rosenau decided that a certain bacterial strain called Streptococcus viridian was responsible.
Rosenau was following the focal infection theory that was prominent at the time. This theory held that the oral cavity was a prime site of infectious transmission. Rosenau and many other doctors believed that bacteria could enter small cuts in the mouth and then travel all throughout the body, wreaking havoc.
While this theory has now been proven to be far overblown, Rosenau's investigation held it as a foundational belief.
The doctor proceeded to inject brain tissue from one of his case studies, apparently infected with Streptococcus, into lab rabbits.
Rosenau recorded both his live patients with EL and his test rabbits. This footage showed similar neck contortions and rigidity in both cases. Therefore, Rosenau concluded he had successfully shown that Streptococcus carried EL from human brain tissue into the rabbits.
From there, Rosenau synthesized a vaccine that he believed would counteract the bacterial agent. He used this vaccine on over 134 patients with EL.
While vaccinating people who are already ill does not make much sense in the current day, doctors such as Rosenau and Neal were following in the footsteps of Louis Pasteur. He had successfully demonstrated that a rabies vaccination could prevent the fatal disease in patients if delivered soon enough after they got sick.
Even so, Rosenau's vaccine was not a huge success. In fact, 113 of his 134 patients actually got worse after receiving his treatment, especially in regard to muscle rigidity, ocular paralysis, and sleep disorder.
Valensky's modern text on EL included an interview with a veterinarian who studied Rosenau's footage of the lab rabbits and concluded their neck posture was most likely due to poor treatment, such as malnourishment and confined cages, rather than a strain of EL.
But when the final Matheson Commission report was published in 1942, Neal still pointed to Rosenau's vaccine as one of the more effective possible avenues of treatment. She didn't want to discourage further research.
Von Economo had also arrived at similar conclusions in his final writing on the subject in 1929. While the epidemic phase was consumed with reports of acute and fast-acting EL, even those who survived this phase of the disease didn't always completely recover.
One example of the continuing scourge of EL can be found in the accounts of the French doctor G.A. Deletier. In the 1950s, 30 years after he contracted EL, he was still suffering from its effects.
As ghost pain still popped up throughout his body, Deletier maintained a productive life, but disability continued to haunt him. He found that his nerves never quite recovered from that initial attack, and his mind was forever changed.
He wrote, "I am no longer the master of myself. My psychological state runs ahead of its center of gravity."
Strange tremors would shake through his body every now and then. It seemed that after he escaped the early, primary phase of encephalitis lethargica, the disease had taken on a different chronic form.
The primary symptoms of EL had now been defined as the presence of encephalitis in the brain, often shown through intense headaches, nausea, or physical aches.
The patient then develops oculogyric crises, or involuntary movements or paralysis in the eyes or ocular nerves.
Then there must be the appearance of what had been deemed Parkinsonian features, made up of speech problems, hurried walking, contorted posture, and other types of muscular seizure or paralysis.
After that, the remaining criteria are sleep disorders, be it hypersomnolence, pseudosomnolence, or even insomnia. It also took into account mental, psychiatric, or behavioral changes, and finally, respiratory anomalies.
Beyond that, encephalitis lethargica also showed itself by remaining inside the patients that survived its acute phase. This is what became known as chronic encephalitis lethargica, and it was this chronic phase that would become the lasting legacy of EL.
As the war ended and the Spanish influenza's infectious strain was cultured by scientists in 1933, the epidemic of acute encephalitis lethargica also began to wane. The last major report was the Matheson Commission's in 1942, before the team was disbanded.
It was almost as if the medical community simply wanted to forget about this strange and incurable mystery. For now, they tended to ignore the lasting effects of EL on its sufferers.
Many survivors of the epidemic tried to ignore the effects as well, including one woman known to history as Frances D. An intelligent go-getter since childhood, Frances had survived acute EL in 1919 and gone on to a successful career as a legal secretary.
And yet, Frances' sickness was far from over after the acute phase. She could deal with the aftershocks of EL at first. She knew when a respiratory crisis was on the horizon.
She even learned to schedule her life around the seizures in her ocular muscles. They came every fifth day in the 1950s. Frances even marked them on her calendar.
But by the mid-1960s, it was clear that these side effects weren't going away. In fact, they were getting worse. Frances would lose control of her gaze, her eyes forcing themselves upward. Her facial muscles would contort in pain into that distinctive, mask-like appearance.
Frances noticed that even her speaking was inhibited. She called it a feeling of resistance that began to constantly push back against her voice and eventually her physical movements.
Her family found it necessary to check her into a hospital at the beginning of 1969. That hospital would soon become known to popular culture as Mount Carmel, but its real name was the Beth Abraham Home for the Incurables.
Frances was put away to be forgotten. This was the fate for many surviving victims of EL, whose chronic phase pulled them back into states of seemingly endless catatonia.
Following the conclusion of the Matheson Commission, the inability to find a cure, and the end of the epidemic phase, research dried up. There was little interest in funding studies into something that most of the world wanted to forget.
It was simply easier to lock this trauma and its victims behind closed doors. After all, there was nothing anyone could do for these remnants of a historical disease. They could only be cared for until their inevitable demise.
But all of that would change when the famed neurologist Oliver Sacks arrived at Beth Abraham. He came equipped with a newly developed drug. Many believed it could be a miracle. The end of not only encephalitis lethargica, but other neurological conditions as well.
Unfortunately, this miracle drug was not everything it seemed.
Thanks for listening to Medical Mysteries. For more information on encephalitis lethargica, amongst the varied sources we used, we found Joel Valensky's Encephalitis Lethargica During and After the Epidemic, extremely helpful to our research.
Next week, we'll follow Oliver Sacks to the Beth Abraham Hospital and into the lives of his patients. His clinical trials of the drug called L-DOPA would lead to a rebirth of hope for the victims of chronic encephalitis lethargica. But it soon became clear that L-DOPA's side effects were more complex than originally anticipated. Were these patients finally freed, or were they only granted a moment's reprieve? We'll find out.
You can find all episodes of Medical Mysteries and all other Parcast originals for free on Spotify.
Not only does Spotify already have all of your favorite music, but now Spotify is making it easy for you to enjoy all of your favorite Parcast originals, like Medical Mysteries, for free, from your phone, desktop, or smart speaker.
To stream Medical Mysteries on Spotify, just open the app, tap Browse, and type Medical Mysteries in the search bar.
And don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Parcast and Twitter at Parcast Network.
We'll see you next time.
Medical Mysteries was created by Max Cutler, is a production of Cutler Media, and is part of the Parcast Network. It is produced by Max and Ron Cutler, sound design by Dick Schroeder, with production assistance by Ron Shapiro, Carrie Murphy, Maggie Admire, and Travis Clark. This episode of Medical Mysteries was written by Jack Bentel and stars Molly Brandenburg and Richard Rossner.